Welcome, listeners, to Gila Members Community Radio Show, Earth Matters. Earth Matters brings you in-depth coverage of local, state, and national environmental issues. Three hosts alternate weekly shows to bring you a broad range of topics and expertise. Your host today is me, Dr. Kim McCrary, Southwest Regional Director and Staff Scientist of the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. The New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, otherwise known as NM Wild, is a grassroots organization dedicated to protecting and restoring New Mexico's wild places through advocacy and education and legislative designations. My guest today is Joe Sines, owner and operator of Wolf Horse Outfitters, a Native American guide service leading trips into our wild places in the Gila. Joe is also a member of the Red Paint Tribal Council, an Apache-based grassroots organization promoting local Apache history and culture, as well as a member of the Mountain Horse Singers, a local powwow and Native songs drum group. Today we'll be talking with Joe about Apache culture and knowledge, the Apache connection to the land, and we're going to talk about two important upcoming events in our community that he will be playing a major role in. So we've got an awful lot to cover here today, so let me first welcome Joe to the show.
Thank you.
The first question that I would like to ask you is, why is land sacred to the Apache?
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me to come in and share some thoughts. One of the things that we are taught is that the reason that land is sacred to us is because we are part of it. And being a part of it, whatever happens to it will happen to us. And so it's a cultural responsibility that we are rather handed and expected to promote and do what we can to retain and continue that integrity of our relationship with the land. And that's why we feel that being conscious of what we do on the land and how we treat it and how we interact with it is very important to us.
Do you see any differences in the native versus non-native relationships with the land?
I think there is quite a bit of difference. There in historical times, certainly the differences were so vast and the philosophy so different that, eventually it did lead to wars, it did lead to conflicts. We believe by being conscious that we are part of the land, our creator-given abilities and expectations of how to live on the land is something that we hold a little bit more closer to our heart. We feel more responsible for things that may go wrong with the land. And I think it's not just seen as an economic force. I think that because of the holistic approach toward Apache culture, everything is involved in what we do, whether it's politics, science, culture, social, political, economic, all of that is going to be an integral part of our existence on that land.
Well, I don't want to put you on the spot, but yeah. I'll go ahead and ask you the next question anyway. Could you really tell our listeners or share with our listeners an example of what it is that the Apache people have done to take care of the land or help the land or to show their connectedness to the land that in fact, let's say, whether it's federal agency or other non-native people have wanted to take a different approach?
The direction that Apaches take differently is that it's the standard that was set in the very beginning. It's not something that has started just recently. It's not something that we hope will start. It's actually what is driving us to that is an appreciation and a respect for the initial code of ethics that Apaches had. Contrary to popular belief, where we were viewed in later history as very ferocious and very aggressive. But in the beginning of Apache culture, through our creation stories, it has to do with peace and harmony. And harmony being living with all other animals and aspects. It, we don't necessarily see the world as a dual existence where most of it is taught in modern schools that everything is either biotic or abiotic. We see a much more connection between everything that most people would consider not living. For example, cesium, being a rock, being a mineral, an element, it has activity. And so that in itself defines that material as living, as moving. And so all those connections are because of a standard that was set for us early to live up to promote, to fight for. And I think those perspectives lead directly to an Apache inherent desire to do things in a way that's going to be a little bit more gentle on the land, a little bit more self-preservation, because again, it's whatever we do on the land, if we're not doing it right and it's hurting the balance and the harmony of it, it's eventually going to come back and hurt us. And even though we are straddled with modern requirements and modern expectations and modern technology, there is still a lot of native people that hold those principles close, and they try to live their lives by them, whether they express it spiritually or economically. Their attempt is to promote that balance, and if it is a disturbed area or if it is something that there's a way to make it heal as soon as possible.
So that kind of leads into my next question, because I was going to ask you about modern times today, and this is something you've been talking about. It sounds like what you're saying is there is a thread, and that thread has continued. And I was going to ask you if the Apache people today share a common outlook when it comes to the land, and I think in part you've answered that question. Is there anything else more you would like to say about that?
I guess, just for the fact is that when we start talking about Native culture and we look at our history and we look at who we are, a lot of us don't want to get stereotyped into just thinking, we're going to think about Apaches as that movie representation. A lot of things we do now is because we are alive right now and we have expectations, we have restrictions, we have desires that are going on right now, and we have to look at Apache culture as something that's current and something that's alive right now. And you may not necessarily see Apaches at a demonstration or carrying on a protest because of some activity going on on some piece of land or some property, but you will see them in ceremonies. You will see them praying for those aspects. And again, it's that effort of us returning to that connection of peace and harmony is where we believe as a people we're going to do more than running around and screaming and yelling and trying to stop some activity we foresee as detrimental to that environment. And so we have that connection of going to our religion, to our economy, to our culture, to try to set that direction of standards to try and keep it alive and keep it going from one generation to the next. And how we're going to teach it and say it in stories to our children and grandchildren so they continue to appreciate that connection and that they're also part of it. It's not just something, Geronimo and Cochise, that they did a long time ago and we can admire them for doing that. But no, that fight still continues. That we see it, we're involved in it. Some of our organizations have been directly involved with protests over mines and things like that, but we're learning that sometimes the old ways do work better. So,
well, we live in a really special place. I think the Gila is just one of the most spectacular places in the lower 48. So, yes, I am biased. But what I wanted to ask you is, I know there's a lot of history here for the Apache. And I wanted to ask you about the Gila region in terms of its special significance to the Apache people.
The Gila itself is a part of what we would consider the traditional Apache territory that was protected, was utilized, and was considered sacred. The whole region was considered sacred. the Gila in our culture was the heartland of the northern stronghold, and that in itself is not just necessarily referring to any kind of military response. It's not necessarily seen as some kind of land base for operations. The northern stronghold for us meant that's where the power laid for the people. That's where they were able to the diet, the economy, the materials, everything. It was the place in this northern region to acquire those materials of quality. The water, the timber, the animals. In our history, we believe that there was a time when those things were in perfect harmony, and they were pristine in their own presence and their own cycles that they were involved in. And so we saw that as a place to go and to acquire power and to produce materials and foods that gave the Apaches that ability to survive as we have up until now.
Well, you have a strong connection to and knowledge of the wilderness in the Gila. I know that because of what you do and who you are. And so what I wanted to ask you is if you could share with our listeners what it feels like just to be there.
You know, I think one of the things that impresses me the most when I'm in that area, and certainly in what is considered the Gila Wilderness, that appreciation and those feelings I get out there are deep set that were begun by my family. And the appreciation that they instilled in me at a very young age of looking at trees, looking at grass, looking at water that was not disturbed, that was in its own presence there as it had been and will be. Where I live now, I guess, a little backtrack of that feeling where I live now, it's a suburb of Silver City, to say the least, and so you have noise, you have dogs, you have roosters, you have trash, you have all those things. And people have asked me, well, you know, for what you do, it seems like you would live closer to the wilderness. My response to that is that, yes, it would be nice to have that remote area, but where do you go from then if there are things that bother you? Where do you go? Right now, where I live, I have a place to go where it is totally quiet and totally clean. I can still go there to feel what I understand is the right place to be. And so we see that place that's always going to be there for us to go and to rejuvenate our spirit. Even modern America's discovering that those wild places offer that. And we've known that for a long time, and so that's why we protected it in the way we did, so we always had a place to go. Again, reference to the northern stronghold. We could be anywhere in our territory, but still know that we could go there and be as it was in old times, and when the culture survived on its own, under its own direction, under its own power. And so to me, to be able to go there and feel that, I think it just strengthens my connection to the past, but it also puts me in that position that I'm a connection to the future. And so even though I can say that it's great to sit out there, it's quiet, it's dark, you can see the stars, you can hear animals a mile away, you can see all the plants that are there, the trees, and how everything relates to each other, it's still, you know, it's still something that offers that connection that I'm part of everything that's going on. And it's something that I have to take seriously because, you know, it's up to us to continue that thread of connection, to pass it on. And if we are able to inspire or even share that knowledge with other people that have that like interest, I think that's what this is all about and why we're here and why we're talking like this. Up until probably about 15, 20 years ago, Apache elders always, you know, encourage us to be somewhat hold our culture, hold our stories, hold things very tightly close to us, and not, you know, not be very open to outsiders, as a lack of better words. But here in the last 15 or so years, we have had elders tell us to share things, because, you know, we realize that our connection to the land is much more than just a fairy tale or a myth. There are things that we know and can do that are going to improve everybody's life. And again, it refers back to that peace and harmony. We're not doing this because we think we're special or that we're different. I think, you know, as human beings, we have that ability to share these things to make somebody else's life better. And, you know, that's what motivates us to share these things.
Well, we're going to take a station break and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Earth Matters. Today, my guest is Joe Sines, owner and operator of Wolf Horse Outfitters, a Native American guide service leading trips into the Gila. And we were just talking about being part of nature, not apart from nature, with Joe. And I wanted, Joe, I know that you lead a lot of trips along the tributaries, or not the tributaries, but the Gila River itself. And given that the Gila River and its watershed is our lifeblood, I mean, it is, I wondered if you could talk about the Gila River and its importance to wildlife, wild places, and people.
The presence of this river in this country is, again, as we see this land, we believe in our creation stories that this land was created specifically for us. And so we believe that that river is there for a reason, and that in that spiritual context of our existence, that our Creator put that river there. And so it's not necessarily just seen as a force of nature that has created that by sheer mechanics of erosion and stuff, and, you know, those processes. But we see it that there was an intentional placing of that river just as it is. And so to see it in its wild form is just an absolute treasure to have that there. And we believe that, you know, that lays in what we call the power of this land. It produces those conditions, those situations, of those waterways. And so being that it's water, just in itself as an element, it's very important. And the contribution that system and those mechanics do, and how it feeds the plants and how it feeds the animals. You know, growing up with my grandfather explaining how trees were like people, how animals were like people, and their nourishment, I can imagine. The elk, the deer, the animals that sustain themselves by drinking that water, eating the plants that sustain themselves by eating that water. It goes beyond that observation that it's just a channel of water going down. It touches everything else, and now even in more of an expanded form, it's touching people's interest in preserving it. And we believe that it's still part of that power of that land. It's always managed to work itself in a form that it protects itself. From the time that we protected it to the time that there's an effort now by the Forest Service to maintain it as a wilderness, the efforts by local organizations to maintain the river as a wild river, we believe that this is not just a simple fact of people being smart and educated and going forth with this, that there is a certain amount of power from the land that directs us and motivates us pushes us to do something about it, to save it, because again, it's I think people don't see that in saving that we're also saving ourselves. It's not just a biological battle. It's going to encompass a lot more things, and in certain cases I think some of the people that are interested in exploiting it, they see that power too. but they don't see it as a whole of what that power can give them. And so it becomes this battle within the culture itself. But they're still sort of fighting for the same thing. And that's a livelihood that waterway is going to give to everything, including us.
Well, why do you think it is that those that don't see it, or may somehow see it on one level, but not doesn't translate into wanting to protect the watershed and that? Why do you think that is? Why is that connection not there for some?
I guess in an Apache perspective, we see that as a possibly as a soul that's not complete. You know, that they have that recognition and they see it there, but there is a break in their ability to look beyond the benefits of the immediate, you know, of the immediate involvement with that particular element or material. They don't see that connection of what it's going to do to their grandchildren, to their great-grandchildren. And I think those are things that are taught. America has its own methods of teaching and you know, how individualism is so important. Apache culture worked on everybody working toward the same thing. The stories, the expectations, it had a common thread of how to act and behave in the environment. And those things were taught from the very beginning. And as much as I refer to it, it goes back to that code of ethics that we as people have to keep continue to enforce and push that, yes, it is about peace and harmony. And so some of these people that are just looking to benefit just for an instant, we see them as they're just not complete, that they haven't seen the whole picture. And that can be inherent from just what they've been taught because of the American culture on how we see individualism and how we see somebody that's very different is going to, in one way, prosper somehow. They don't see the value of being a united front toward that. That's sort of my best explanation of why people may not see that connection. So.
No, I thank you very much. I personally think that was eloquently said, but in any event, so thank you. And it kind of leads into the next thing that I was thinking about, and you've alluded to it throughout the whole conversation today, and I can sense that when you talk about the land and when you talk about being in the wilds, that you bring something with you when you leave and you go through your daily life. So, because you just kind of alluded to it in the conversation here. And so I was going to ask you, what do you carry with you in your daily life from these special places that you're talking about?
One of the things that inspires me to live every day, I think it's that feeling that I can make a difference here. Whether it's by being here and sharing some of these thoughts that hopefully somebody will listen to, or just by the fact that I don't do something, I don't leave a mark, I don't leave a scrape, I don't, you know, when I walk into the wilderness and I sit with people, just the simple fact of how you sit, people don't realize the impact they have. And I always look, and sometimes I say something and sometimes I don't, depending on the person's, you know, makeup and how my relationship is with them. But even simple fact of, like I say, sitting in the wilderness on a log or a rock and scraping your feet. Once you get up and leave, you left an area that is scraped up and bared out because either by nervousness or just not understanding of your place with it, you sit there and you rub your feet. But then you get up and leave and you left a mark. For me, I sit and I try to be real still, so when I leave, it doesn't look like I was there. And so those little things are kind of some of those things that I carry with me and saying, okay, well, even this little mark is something that I can avoid. So it's not necessarily what we do or what we get out of it, but sometimes what we don't do and don't get out of it.
So if I can generalize, and perhaps I cannot, I wanted to ask you what the Apache relationship is with non-human animals, particularly predators like critically endangered Mexican wolves or jaguars, which hopefully we might have a few around here that no one knows about, but I can't say that is the case.
You know, the thought of the place of all these people, which is what we have usually referred to them, the animal, the plants, we refer to them as people. And so we believe that at one time in our creation and our evolving in this world was that there was a time when plants, animals, rocks, people could all communicate. So we see that if we can communicate them and talk to them in the past, we see them that to a certain extent they were a relation to us. They were somebody that so to us, considering an animal, considering it's like considering relations, cousins, aunts, uncles, relatives, and so to see those animals, I can't think of any effort ever to annihilate any type of animal throughout our history. I know there's examples of ranchers in White Mountain that are concerned about the wolves that were released there, and efforts in their cooperation with trying to bring that under control. But I know that in most Native cultures that I know of, there hasn't been any effort necessarily to wipe out an animal because it creates a hardship or it's creating a threat. And I think it's mostly because we've grown up and been instilled with that idea of our creation being that we are part of everything. And animals are a relation to us. So their place and their being here is important. The wolf, the cougar, they all have their place. Everything has their place and what they contribute to the balance of everything. The jaguar, I hear stories, it's here. And, you know, I heard one person tell me they saw it right in front of Asian Buffet. One crossing there, and how, you know, so the rumor control, and so I don't know, maybe it's coming downtown to shop, or
maybe Asian food.
And so, you know, I guess if it's part of our economy and it's gonna bring interest, it's, and I'm not totally aware of the conditions that the jaguar is dealing with now, and what its place is gonna be, but. There's things moving all over. The time I spent in Alaska, when I first got there were no, by thought, there was no cougar or coyote in Alaska. By the time I left Alaska, they were being spotted in Southeast. And so, you know, we know these animals are moving around, and there's a reason for it. So we need to pay attention to it.
And we'll be taking a station break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Dr. Kim McCrary here with Earth Matters, and we have as our guest today Joe Sines. Joe is owner and operator of Wolf Horse Outfitters, a Native American guide service that leads trips into the Gila Wilderness and Aldo Leopold Wilderness. And we've just been talking about the Apache's relationship to predators such as wolves and jaguars. And I wanted to follow up, Joe, because I wanted to ask you, how do you think we could cultivate a greater respect for our land, our wildlife, our natural resources?
It's something that's instilled very early, and I think one of the things that Native cultures do is again the importance of what you teach your children. For some of the ideas and perspectives that I have, it's not something that I just discovered 10 years ago or 5 years ago. These are some of the things that my family has instilled in me. And so I think in parents and teachers and grandparents, I think if they can teach the children the dialogue, the words, the impressions is, you know, something that I think is very vital. One of the examples that I came across here recently was at a festival that a friend of mine saw a little boy with a piece of candy, and the little boy ate the candy and had the candy wrapper, and For just a moment, the little boy seemed concerned about what he was going to do with the wrapper, and he seemed not sure of what to do with it. And apparently, what I understand is that the dad stepped in and said, "Just throw it down. Just throw it down. Just get rid of it." And the little boy did it, and the dad high-fived him. And so, you know, it's little things like that that those kids remember. By experience and by growing up, some of the things that impress us. And little things like that, you know, if that little boy admires his dad, it's something that he will remember. And I think that sets, you know, that sets that philosophy of what you do with something if you don't know what to do with it. And it becomes a very easy process of just, you know, tossing it. And so I think that's, you know, part of it too, and sort of relating back to the whole idea of how do we learn these things with predators. I was taught that the minute you eat wildlife as subsistence, or the minute that you eat elk as a gift or fish and eat fish, you have automatically put yourself in the food chain of that natural cycle. And so again, we're taught, you know, to act a certain way. There is an expected behavior. So with this wildlife, we are instructed that we need to act as the predators that we are. And if you see your relationship with animals in that particular way, it encourages you to be more mindful of their habits, more mindful of their own existence, and more cautious of how you are in their territory, in their land, in their habitats, and it's a better way to survive. And so those things being taught early can make you see the world just a bit different. And once you see it a bit different, then I think the natural thing is then to act a little bit different. Luckily for me, that's, you know, the things that my grandparents, my parents, my uncles, aunts, you know, that they instilled in me to look at things and in a certain light to promote it that way. Natural things, non-packaged trash, animals, it's all related in that way.
So. You know, it's interesting you say that, because as a child, when I littered, I was reprimanded harshly. And I deserved it, but it definitely had an impact on me. And also, when you talk about becoming more aware of your surroundings, when you were talking about predators, it's that idea of your senses being alive. And there's just something about that that I think you convey very well, that I can relate to. And I hope that many of our listeners can relate to it as well. One thing I didn't mention at the start of the program is that Joe is also a movie consultant and actor. And I was hoping you could tell us more about why and how you are involved with the movie industry.
Originally, my interest in film work sort of stemmed from just the fact of horse work. Being involved in scenes and film work that involved horses and action. And that was the initial interest that I, you know, had in working with film. As time went on, and what I saw was that there was an actual interest in portraying Native cultures, and that furthered my interest in wanting to become involved in it. But also to the point of wanting to promote the proper history, the proper context of our history, the actual history itself, the details of it, in that hopefully my involvement would promote a better understanding and portrayal of Native issues or Native actors or Native situations in film. And that is what has motivated me a lot to become involved in some of these films, is almost to, well, you know, hopefully there'll be money in it, but to also be a part of that. Okay, we're gonna hopefully encourage the producers, encourage the directors to do the right portray Apache culture as what it really was and really is, and not just that stereotype.
So that's something I wanted to ask you. What are some of the myths about Apache culture and traditions that we see in the movies?
You know, it may not be done intentionally, but I think just because of the mechanics of a film and the expectations of a film, there are certain things done for just that value alone. But I think they're missing some of the potential of the actual true portrayal and true, you know, representation that is not being seen. The one example that I can say is that in my last work that I did on film, it's a film that was offered, a film part that was offered to me to play the role of a medicine man. And the age and the circumstances of this medicine man, I think, were highly influenced by the producer's own perspectives. You know, I thought it was rather entertaining, or even just as a misconception, the way this medicine man was portrayed was a man that, by his spirituality, was celibate most of his life. And I have never met a medicine man that is celibate. You know, to me, that was a direct perspective from a spiritual point that maybe these people that produced or set up this dialogue and this person's character did not know that medicine men are not like Catholic priests. They're very different. And so we see that.
So did you convey that to the producer?
We tried, but you know, sometimes it seems like in films it gets to a point where they're more concerned about the bottom line than actually taking the time to rewrite or portray with extra time and effort to portray the right thing. And I, you know, for whatever the value of representing a medicine man in that way, it's still a misconception as far as we're concerned.
What do you find generally that producers are responsive, or has it just kind of been a mixed bag for you?
It changes. You know, some producers may start not very interested because they have their idea and they have their plot, their story, their film sort of in the making, and they're not hoping to get too far off, and of course budgets and things like this. But some people do listen, some people do want to learn, and so it changes. You know, one of the films that I worked on, The Missing, I remember being in one of the auditions, the fourth audition I went through, and in that particular audition, Ron Howard was questioning me about, you know, his interest in portraying Apache culture right, and that he was interested in that the proper language was used. And it was interesting to me when he asked me what my recommendations were to accommodate the language. I mentioned to him to go to Mescalero and to talk with the elders there, meaning the Chiricahua elders, and he had no idea that there were Chiricahua people in Mescalero. And so when I recommended Mescalero, he sort of tried to stop me and correct me that no, he wasn't interested in Mescalero, he was interested in Chiricahua. And I said, well, that's where some of the elders of the Chiricahua are, is they're at Mescalero. And so that history, he wasn't very aware of that history. So he learned something, and I was hoping I wasn't going to get...
Great. Which is great.
And I was hoping I wasn't going to get fired for contesting.
Hopefully you made some money, and they kept you on, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I think we'll take a station break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Earth Matters. And Joe Sines, there's something I've really been wanting to ask you, and that is, how did you choose the name for your guide service, Wolf Horse Outfitters?
Well, beginning my business, I wanted to be unique, and I believe that the best way to represent myself was to just do that, represent myself and what I was going to do as a business. And I decided to use my Indian name, my native name, because it, to me, it, you know, even though I don't normally promote it as that is my Indian name, I think it's a big part of me and who I am. And so I decided to use that name as the identifying title for the type of service that I would provide or the type of business that I wanted to become involved in. So it's my end name, and it does describe what I do. It does identify me as a person of that background.
Well, you've talked about it a bit during the show already, but I was just hoping you could talk about it a bit more in terms of your philosophy and practice of treading lightly on the land. You did mention about how one sits in that, but I was hoping you could discuss that more, along with connecting that to survival skills, because I understand you also teach survival skills to people that you bring on your trips.
Yes, one of the ideas of the type of service that I wanted to provide in this business, again, had to do with the Apache philosophy of treading lightly on the earth. And it's something that I wanted to take very serious, and not just because it was a business tactic, but because, for who we are, we have to sort of try to maintain that standard. And the only way to really promote this effort of treating the land differently was to do it myself and do it as an example and show it as an example to visitors and people that would patronize my business, that there is a different way to do things. Again, it's just me showing it and doing it in front of them for them to see it, and not just talk about it. And so, the fact of sitting there and how you move and how you treat that little spot of land, everything to, what materials you take, what you carry, what you feel you're dependent on. And so there's a way to situate your gear, situate your behavior in that activity to lessen the impact that you have. It's difficult to just promote a type of survival skills, because I don't think Apaches necessarily had to survive here. We like to believe that Apaches thrived here. So it wasn't of them running around just trying to find food and trying. They actually existed on this land in a way that they were thriving, that their numbers increased, their health increased. Things they did created a group of people that were extremely healthy and well-fed. I mean, the amount of food that's out there, all the plants that are in the wilderness and the forest, Apaches had a use for all of them. And so... It's not a matter of survival, it's just a matter of knowing the uses of those plants, the uses of techniques. One of my philosophies in the work that I do is that anything you carry should have at least two uses to it, not just one. And if you have an item that only has one use, maybe learning how to do without it or minimizing it may be, something you can learn. But everything else, all gear, has to have at least two uses, or I prefer not to take it. And so, to set yourself up to be able to survive, quote unquote, in this land, I think it's more of a matter of taking an interest in the individual plants, the animals. What is their meaning? For me to go out there, I don't think I would have to fish to survive out there, mostly because the fish was a taboo food for Apaches. And so, we didn't need that food to live in the past, so obviously I don't need it now to live in the future or in the contemporary time, and there's other plants we can utilize.
So I'd like to say to our listeners that if you'd like more information, you can go to wolfhorseoutfitters.com. And Joe, we are coming closer to the end of the show, so I did want to bring up two events that I know that you're very much involved with. The first one is the 9th Annual Red Paint Powwow and Indian Market. And I was wondering if you could share with our readers when it is, where it is, what kind of events will be offered, and can you use any volunteers?
Well, the 9th Annual Red Paint Powwow is scheduled for January 18th, 19th, and 20th, and it will be at the University Intramural Gym. We're really excited about the progress that we have in putting it together and what we have scheduled. One of our efforts here with our intent of why we put this event on is that we want to promote Apache culture in a different light. And we want to bring these events into Silver City, everything from hoop dancers to flute players to singers, drummers, dancers. And so the powwow itself is scheduled as a 3-day event, and Friday we tried to make it available to the school kids because we believe that this is, you know, an important part of our statement here, is that we are very much concerned with the education, and so we try to provide these events for school kids to come and see, and see it in a proper light, and see it under you know, proper circumstances. The Indian market itself is something that we hope continues to promote Native culture, Native art. We've always been interested to try to bring that type of art to Silver City, to have it more available here. And so even though we bring in Native artists and Native materials one time a year, we hope that eventually this is something that will become more available here in Silver City. And by just bringing it here as much as we can, hopefully it'll stick one of these days.
Can you use any volunteers? Do you need volunteers?
Yes, we do. You know, at the moment, the planning for the powwow is formulating in a way that we're getting close to assigning the volunteer positions. And you know, anybody that is willing to give us a hand, and we encourage you to contact us.
Can you tell them, can you give out the contact information?
One of the contact numbers for the Red Paint Powwow is 575-534-1379, and an additional contact number is John Gonzalez at 575-654-6161, and we'd be glad to answer any questions.
Great. Now, not only are you involved with this, but we have another event, a new event that's actually coming to Silver City, and that is an economic forum entitled Community Development, Tourism, and Public Lands. And it's being sponsored by the Southwest New Mexico Green Chamber of Commerce, as well as the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, the organization that I work with. And Joe, you are going to be one of our expert panelists here. I want to let folks know that we've got short presentations being given by three people. Ben Alexander, the Associate Director and Co-Founder of Headwaters Economics, and he'll be talking about community development and public lands. And we have Catherine Wanick with the Southwest New Mexico Regional Tourism Board. She's the Gila representative, and she's also the owner of the Black Range Lodge in Kingston, New Mexico. And Catherine's going to be talking about New Mexico True, quality of life issues, economic data having to do with New Mexico. And then, Joe, you are going to be participating, and perhaps you could briefly tell folks what it is that your presentation will be about.
One of the interests that our organizations here have, and it's basically, you know, like I said, it's almost to say that it's a grassroots effort, because it's most of us live here, and we're, you know, trying to make a difference in Silver City itself. But we feel that Native culture, contemporary Native culture, is a economic potential that's available to Silver City. And, you know, we hope that Silver City will see the value in it by trying to, you know, encourage Native performers, Native art, Native vendors to come to this area. That it will eventually be seen as a viable economic impact into the area. And so I am interested in sharing ideas and thoughts about how to utilize Native culture to promote Silver City. You know, Silver City in the past, as far as Native cultures are concerned, we've had a very tenuous relationship in past history. But it's different now. And, you know, we can see that together we can promote ourselves and promote Silver City and make Silver City a Native venue. for arts and culture and music, and we hope to bring that here. And so that's an interest that I have in promoting what we do here and what we see our potential as contributors to the economy here in the Silver City area.
And to enable us to have this discussion, these presentations will take up probably 45 minutes to an hour maximum, and then we will have a community dialogue. So we're hoping to encourage business people, budding entrepreneurs, public officials, general public, just interested in diversifying our economy and celebrating Native culture to come. So we'd like to encourage you and let you know that it is Wednesday, December 12th from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the Silco Theater. If you're looking for parking, you can park in the Silver City Visitor Center parking lot and walk right over the bridge. Our moderator will be Sissy McAndrew, who is, many people know her well, Executive Director of the Southwest New Mexico Green Chamber. And we really hope to see all of you there. I'd like to just say, Joe, thank you very much for being with us today. It's actually been a pleasure for me to be able to talk with you. And I'm sure that our listeners really appreciated what you had to say. And to our listeners, I would like to thank all of you for tuning into Earth Matters, a show about earthly matters that impact us all.